The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight marks Maxine Hung Kingston's third decade of talks at the library, which began back in 2003 with her discussion of the fifth book of Peace, a diary-like book prompted by the death of her father and the loss in a fire of her house and the manuscript of her novel, The Fourth Book of Peace. She joined us again in 2011 with I Love a Broad Margin to My Life. Her reflections on aging and her life as a writer, peace activist, teacher, and mother. You can find the podcasts on our website. Her latest work, presented in a handsome and everlasting form by the Library of America, collects three of Hung Kingston's award-winning classics, including Woman Warrior, Chinamen, and Tripmaster Monkey, along with a collection of essays about her time living in Hawaii, and difficult-to-find writings in which she examines her creative process and the works of other writers. Maxine Hung Kingston is a professor emerita at the University of California, Berkeley, a recipient of the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature, the National Humanities Medal, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award, among many, many others. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with one of my favorite writers, Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathizer, and most recently, the raucous and endlessly entertaining follow-up, The Committed. Maxine, Viet, thanks for joining us again. The screen is yours.
Thanks so much, Andy. Hi, Maxine. Good seeing you again.
Hi, Viet.
Good seeing you again for the third time in about, I think, a month. So for those of you who don't know out there, I am the editor of the Library of America edition of Maxine's work. And what we've done is we've had, you know, a couple of conversations with each other already about Maxine's career and her writings and her life. And this is our third and final conversation celebrating this wonderful publication of the Library of America volume. And I think, Maxine, you're going to start off with some readings from your work.
Yes, thank you, Viet, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining me at this time of at this plague time during this war time. And I'm going to read something from Hawaii One Summer, in which I'm giving us some thoughts about what to do during a time like this. In 1980, I was recognized as a living treasure of Hawaii. As a responsible living treasure, I feel called upon to tell you a story that will give help and power. Once there was a prophecy that Kamehameha would conquer all the islands if he could build a great temple to his family war god, Kukailimoku. Setting some of the lava rocks and boulders with his own hands, Kamehameha built the heiau on Pu'ukohola, the hill of the whale. To dedicate it, he summoned his cousin, Keoua Ku'ahu'ula, ruler of the rest of the big island, to come to the ceremony. It was understood that Keoua would be the gift to the war god. In honor, he could not refuse this call, but he emasculated himself. Kamehameha would not have a perfect male sacrifice. Kamehameha, waiting on shore, Keoua arose in his canoe. Keoua's blood and damaged body sanctified the new temple. Enmity between their two clans lasted for 200 years. in 1991, descendants of Kamehameha and descendants of Kahua had an inspiration to heal the bitterness, grievances, and enmity of the past 200 years. The families gathered at Pu'ukohola Heiau and recreated the events of long ago. Kahua approaches Kamehameha. This time they meet and walk on together. In the United States, oh, I have to tell you that this was, this event was partly sponsored by the U.S. National Park Service, because this Heiau is a national park. So this recreation, this redoing of history was done by Americans. In our history of mainland America, there has been a terrible war, a civil war, whose consequences last till today. And the Civil War battles and events, they are the most recreated dramas. The many recreations of Civil War battles. And Earl, my husband, was playing U.S. Grant. And so he and I were at a Civil War reenactment. And I think we do these reenactments not just because they're dramatic, but they are an attempt to reconcile what's happening, just the way that they did it in Hawaii. And one way they reenacted things was on Friday, the South would win the battle. And then on Sunday, the North would win the battle, the same battle. And sometimes they would do it the other way. Sunday, the South wins. Saturday, the North wins. And another thing they did at this reenactment was that they had a church, and it was the actual church that they had used in the Civil War. And on Sunday, everybody goes to church, and Jefferson Davis is there. Abraham Lincoln is there. Robert E. Lee is there. And U.S. Grant is there. And their wives. And there is a church ceremony. And again, a reenactment, a new ritual that's performed in the church. And that is that there were canteens. What they were reenacting was, now this actually happened in battles. Sometimes we have bodies lying around all over the place, and soldiers would bring water even to the enemy. They gave water, they helped the wounded from the other side. And so for the ritual in church, what they did was there were canteens of water, and we drank from the water and passed it to the next person and the next person, and we all drank from these canteens. It was a kind of communion, and it wasn't wine. It was this water. And so with actual people, there were many descendants there, actors. There were many descendants there from people who had actually fought in the war. So I see this as a way to reconcile and to change history. This is magic. It's amazing. I got to tell you one more thing that happened. I mean, Earl and I were Westerners. We don't know. And so we did this. Then coming out of the church, I saw a plaque. And it was the names of the people who had founded this church. And the two names at the top, somebody Kingston and somebody Hong. And so here we are. We're Earl and I, we had ancestors that founded this church. And who knew? I mean, I didn't know there was a Hong, a Chinese who was in the Civil War and who founded this church. And Kingston, I mean, Earl, that's not even a real name. He's got a fake name because he's Jewish or partly Jewish, and they changed their name and they don't even remember what their original name was. But there it is. There's a Kingston and Hong, and look at the karma. Years later, a Kingston and a Hong who were fighting each other, or maybe now they're married. So I just wanted to tell you the magic and the consequences of what dramatists and writers and what ritual can do.
Well, that's beautiful. And as someone who also works on war and memory in my other life, or career as a scholar, I'm well aware of the importance of the rituals that you're talking about, the rituals of remembrance, the rituals of reconciliation, bringing up the past, not in order to relive it and to repeat the horrors of the past, but to remind people that these things actually happened, both the horrors, but also the sacrifices and the contributions as well. And, it seems to me that literature is kind of ritualistic in that way as well. We get together to talk about literature, we do literary readings and so on, but the very act of writing and of reading can become ritualistic. There's a way by which stories, whether they're oral stories, and we'll talk about oral stories with your work, or whether they're written stories, they're a way for us to connect with the past and who we were, who we are as a culture. And I'm proud to say, happy to say too, that your work continues to be recognized for its contributions, not just with the Library of America, but we just learned that you received an award from the American Psychiatric Association. And I think there's a connection here, between what you were talking about in terms of ritual and remembrance and the writer's role, and here the writer's role in understanding human psychiatry. Can you tell us just a little bit about what the award is and why it was given to you?
I think the award is given to people who have given knowledge or research or to psychiatry. And I don't know whether it's been given to a writer before, but I think about what was specifically they have said that I am being awarded to my contributions about the psychology of Asian Americans. And I have thought about what is it that I've done that's given knowledge about us. And I do know that I have seen a psychology paper in a journal in which they cited my writing in The Woman Warrior, in which I was describing one of my aunts who committed suicide. I have quite a few aunts and uncles who committed suicide. And I was saying that I thought that crazy people tell the same story over and over again, and the healthy people will tell new stories. This was from hearing people who are mentally ill repeat themselves over and over again. So that was quoted in a psychology journal. I think another insight that I had was about immigrants. So just watching the immigrants in my family and the way they couldn't speak English, also observing myself when I did not know English, I saw how language and the inability at language, the inability to communicate, the inability to understand what you are hearing, but that causes paranoia. And you know, you can react to paranoia in all kinds of ways. And I could see, that reminds me of something that was happening in the stores in Chinatown. The store owners, the clerks in Chinatown, they made up their minds. They telling each other, you know, when we're waiting on people, don't speak to each other in Chinese. Don't speak in Chinese because it gets the white customers all paranoid. So I think in writing, I did a lot to figure out how language affects our psyche.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I really remember the first one that you mentioned about the madness being a form of repetition, the woman warrior, and going back again to the idea of ritual and remembrance and the writer's ability to talk not only about some kind of fictional situation, but about a larger historical situation. I mean, countries that repeat themselves over and over and over again, you know, despite all the warning signs that they should change and do something different and diversify their practices and their understanding of the past and their behaviors. That's kind of dangerous behavior as well. I think you're a really good analyst of human psychology. You do recommend that I go see a therapist, which, you know, you were probably right about, but, you know, it's not your fault that I did not go to get therapy after that. I, you know, in our third and final conversation, I wanted to ask you some broader questions, and there'll be some tech-specific questions. And if you and the audience have tech-specific questions or anything else, put them in the chat. But I wanted to ask some broader questions. You know, you are now at a point in your life where you have the Library of America volume. John Wayland Bridge is writing a biography of your life. You were anointed as a living treasure of Hawaii. So you've reached a certain, I don't know if it's a peak, but a certain elevation in your career. And some would say that you're famous. How do you feel about that? I mean, how do you deal with this idea of you no longer being an aspiring writer, but as a writer who's become canonical, who's become canonized, as the Library of America volume signifies. And one more thing I'll mention is that the NPR just did a great review of this new Library of America volume. I'm going to put it into the chat. And the reviewer, John Powers, rightfully mentions you as someone who should be spoken of in the same breath as James Baldwin, Joan Didion, and Kurt Vonnegut. And that you were a writer who's opened doors and paved the way for writers like Amy Tan, Juno Diaz, Charles Yu, and myself. So you're a writer of a certain stature. I don't know, what do you feel about that?
Well, I wish it would give me more confidence. I would think that that I should be going around not so afraid. Or how am I going to write what I'm going to write? I also look back and I see mistakes that I've made. That's not good enough. I think that about everything I've ever written. It's not good enough. One thing I would do right afterwards, when something's not good enough, I would say, okay, just put it into the next book. And so I've been doing that. But still, it's not good enough. And so in some ways, it's not good enough to win all these awards. So what I'm working on now, from the beginning, I look at something and it's forbidden. Like my mother told me, don't tell any of this stuff. So it's forbidden. So I have to figure out a way how to do this. And so my latest idea is looking at a diary that I kept about 10 years ago. It's about 2,000 pages long. And I wrote it thinking it was going to be secret and I will not publish it. I was even thinking, oh, okay, I'll just put something 100 years after I die. Let's do that. And that's exactly what Mark Twain did. I'll do what Mark Twain did, publish my autobiographical writings after I die, 100 years. Okay, so I even sent that to my agent. So from now on, anything I write, just wait. But I've been reading it lately and I think it's pretty good. And but then I'm writing about everybody I know. And so my next idea is to show it to all the 400 people I write about, and I'll do whatever they say. That's where I am right now.
I would rather see the unabridged or undiluted version where you say what you really thought. I don't know. I think if you publish it now and there was controversy, that would be a good thing. I mean, you're a modest person. I think a modest person in your public persona. You don't pick fights. You don't go out of your way to pick fights, although people have had fights with you. But, you know, picking fights is actually a pretty good way to generate some controversy and some blame on the literary reputation stage.
But, Viet, it's okay for big public literary fights. That's okay. But I don't want to pick any fights with my loved ones. I can't do that.
From our last conversation, someone in the audience had a question they never got to ask. I think it's a pretty good one because a lot of people have this question for a lot of writers. It relates to just what you talked about. The question was roughly, How do you deal with airing a family's dirty laundry? Now, you know, whether the laundry is dirty or not, that's a kind of a subjective question, but there's no doubt that your work involves revelation sometimes of family secrets, even if they're masked or changed in certain kinds of ways. Here you're talking about another issue personal things that you feel uncomfortable publishing, at least at this point. Your standard for dealing with material that involves other people and their reluctance to have their stories aired?
Well, I have been dealing with it since the very beginning. And here's one solution. It was very important to my family that we not let anybody know that we are illegal immigrants. And all my life, there's been fear of deportation. But the stories of how my parents got here are so wonderful, so dramatic, including stowing away on the ships and getting caught and getting deported. And I really want to tell those stories, but I can't. And so what can I do? So one way is to tell a fictional story. And one way is to tell the real story. So in China Men, I have four stories about how my father got to America. There's the mythic story where Chinese women are so magical and powerful that they can give birth at a distance. So my grandmother was in China, and then my father was born in America. And okay, so I have that story. And then there's the story of the earthquake and fire in Chinatown, in San Francisco, and the Hall of Records burned, and my father's birth certificate was lost in that fire. That is a story that Ram Takaki tells in his a book about immigrants. He says that if all of the Chinese that say that they are immigrants, then he's got the numbers. Then every woman must have given birth to 800 people. So I've got that story. And then I have a story which I call the story of the legal father. And so I tell a whole story of what happens when you get to Angel Island and the questions that are asked and how he got it and the conditions on Angel Island where they were writing poetry and the fake, well, how he answered it and then how he legally got in. And then the fourth story is where he sails from Cuba and there are dragons in the water and he's nailed inside of a box and in the cargo hold and how he almost gets caught and he gets to New York. He gets caught, he gets deported, he does it again, gets deported, he does it again. And finally he gets there on the day that Charles Lindbergh landed in Paris. And my father jumps up in the air and says, "We did it, Charles and I did it." Okay, now that is the real story of how my father got to America. But I wrote it as, well, this can't be true. This is so fanciful. Oh, when I was teaching at Berkeley, I don't remember whether I did this in your class yet, but there were some classes where I read the legal story and then I read the illegal story and I asked the students, which one do you think is real and which one is fiction? And you know what? It was almost unanimous that they picked the actual story. They said the actual story was fake and the real story as fiction. And this is what I wanted. If any FBI or anybody read my books, I would fool them. And the reason it works is that I wrote the fictional story realistically. Realism. I told exactly what the place looked like and how the people dressed and how they talked and how the legal language they were using. I used a realistic style. And then for the stowing away on the ship, I made it was high adventure. It was metaphors, lots of metaphors of the way the ocean was, and just really fanciful writing. And so I just fooled everybody into thinking that was fiction.
That is a great, great story and a great lesson for writers and for readers out there as well, you know, because I remember reading these passages in the first two books, Woman Warrior, Chipmaster Monkey, and certainly remembering the flourishes and the fantastic dimensions of these stories and thinking, yeah, she probably made that stuff up. This is the writer coming into play. So I will make a note of this myself and steal from you later, and I will give you no credit for it when I do it, okay? Another broad question. In one of your books, Broad Margin, you talk about aging, and I wonder now, you mentioned you're 81, whether your thinking on age and aging has changed, both relative, obviously, to your own personal life and everything, but also to your status as a writer and your writing craft. I mean, you also talked about how, despite all the years and decades of experience and wisdom, it's still kind of a terrifying experience for you in a lot of ways. So where's your thinking now around aging?
I think I've been writing about aging for quite a few decades now. And I think for my last two books, last two or three writings that I've done, at the end of the book, I would say that, okay, this is it. I've said everything I want to say. This is the end. In fact, I Love a Broad Margin to My Life, I write about the ending. I write about Famulan committing suicide. So I am thinking of death and the end, and think of myself coming to an end. I wrote a list of reasons why not to commit suicide. And I'm also thinking, I'm trying to face the end and why not come to an end. And each time I have also said that, okay, this is my last work. I'm not going to do anymore. And part of that is, you know, I think of writing, for me anyway, most of my life I've put writing first. And I've got to get off by myself and write. Everybody is getting in the way, and especially awful when I had a baby. And so a lot of, so many times I just locked him up and so that I could be by myself and so I could write. I think I have neglected my family. I've neglected friends. And so part of this, as I'm aging, I think, okay, I'm going to stop writing and live. I'm going to spend more time with my friends, my family. I've got two grandchildren now. I'm going to live with, I'm going to see those grandchildren. I'm going to spend all day and night with those kids. And it doesn't matter about the writing. It's, so I have actually in my old age now, I am no longer going to put writing first. There are days when I can just work in the garden. Oh, I can even go to parties, if not for COVID. I don't know whether I even wrote this, but there's a whole scene in China Men where there's a party going on. This is in New York. Everybody else is having, I'm staying in an apartment with writers and actors. They are having a party. I am in a corner on my typewriter. I mean, that's the way I've lived my life. And, oh, Viet, you were my student. I think of myself as a very bad teacher because I try to do as little work as I could for my classes because I want to spend time on my own writing and not on my students.
Well, I actually taught my very first creative writing workshop ever this past semester with 9 students. And I have to say, it was the easiest class I ever taught because I put any effort into it, you know. So I think writing instructors have a real scam going on over here, and I'd be happy to participate more. You know, I have questions for you still, but you know, there are also some good questions from the audience as well. And you raised the question of suicide, the end of life, and Ilana Lim asks that she says Maxine mentions aunts and uncles who committed suicide. Do you think that was a consequence of immigrating to America, or was it happening in China?
Yes, some in China and some in America. And I do feel that the immigration itself is traumatic, especially when you get here and you don't know the language. Everything is different, and you don't find this gold mountain. It's not a gold mountain. Oh, and then also a lot of people came escaping a war. My mother did that, and also a famine. I have aunts and cousins who came here. They had escaped famine. So there were already terrible conditions. And then they come here, and there's more trauma. So this can happen here. It can happen there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we started off with a discussion of Asian American psychiatry and psychology and, you know, the implied issues of mental health and everything like that. And even though I think generally writers, fiction writers and so on, we don't use terms like mental health in our writing, oftentimes it does, the writing does deal with the actual consequences on people's mental health of the traumas that they've been through from war and migration and all these other kinds of struggles and so on. So I think that's an important thing to point out. I just want to drop another article in the chat. I just read a New Yorker interview with Wayne Wang by Hua Xu. And number one, Wayne Wang also talks about the fact that, you know, failure is something that he always confronts, and that being scared is a good thing for an artist. I agree with both those. I agree with both of those things. They're not comfortable things to experience, but they're very necessary. And he mentions his older brother's schizophrenia and attributes it at least partly to the immigrant experience that his brother underwent. So I wanted to ask about, since we talked about teaching, the teaching relationship and everything, I wanted to ask you whether, you know, what was your experience as a student? Were there teachers who were important to you, whether those were teachers in a classroom or whether those were writers who were teachers who really marked you positively or negatively in some ways?
As far as the writing goes, I never took a creative writing class. They didn't have creative writing in those days. I thought I could learn from just teaching, reading literature, but that's all criticism. There was one creative writing class when I was at Cal, but it was taught just like a literature class. I mean, we just read books and they said, well, this part is good. You could imitate this or that. So I actually felt that my education at Berkeley stopped my writing. After I graduated, I couldn't write. And I think it was because we learned how we had a critical mind. We learned how to write essays and criticism, but we never learned to write about our feelings or about our personal lives. Oh, the way I came back from that was I did cross training and I painted for a year or two, and then the writing came back. And I think that had to do with using the senses. You're also looking at perspective, point of view, metaphors. That's all in the painting. But the really good teachers I have were in grammar school and some high school students, but in grammar school was when I was writing poems, and the teachers, they read my poems and they gave me ideas and they taught me how to do scansion and rhythm. And that was, for the writing, the most encouraging was when I was a kid. In high school, it wasn't so much the writing, but there were teachers who really cared about me. They would take me and other kids places that we would never know about. They gave us food and events, and they were just good to us. So that's my experience of teachers.
Yeah, I had some similar experiences at Berkeley. You know, I learned how to be a thinker, a theorist, a scholar, and then it took many years to, you know, it's a hard language to acquire, and then it took many years to unlearn that language so that I could write fiction, still incorporating all the very serious ideas I learned at Berkeley. And in fact, one of my most influential teachers was in the third grade, who gave me the opportunity to write my first book and set me on the path to, you know, over 30 years of misery in trying to become a writer at her encouragement. So it goes both ways. We have a question here from the writer Wayne Carlin, who was with us at the last conversation.
Oh, hello, Wayne.
Yeah, great, fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know Wayne Carlin, although you should, you know, he was a veteran of the war in Vietnam, and then he became a novelist and a memoirist. So his question is, would Maxine care to speak about her writing workshops with Vietnam veterans? Were they helpful for their trauma, and was working with them in any way either traumatic or healing, or both, for you?
Oh, Wayne, I think I've had the same experience as you did at the Institute for, what is it, for the Understanding of War and Social Consequences. Oh, you should have been there. Yes, on Saturday. Saturday, we had our 30th anniversary of the Veteran Writers Workshop. And we met in Tilden Park underneath. We all fit underneath a giant willow tree. And we talked about the last 30 years. We are amazed that we have lasted for 30 years without breaking apart, and how we grew our community. And we have vowed to be together for the rest of our lives. And during this time, some of the things I've noticed have changed. Many people who were single are now have a partner and are married, and there are lots of people who have published. We put together an anthology, Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace, and we have sent that money to Vietnam, where we helped start a school. Okay, we did have people who committed suicide. We do have people who quit, but on the whole, everybody has, most people's lives are much better. Oh, and as for the writing, at the beginning, when a person first joins the group, they write their trauma. It's terrible things that happened in the war or when they were a kid. But as time goes by, they can write about something else. They could write a love story. They could write a fiction that has nothing to do with the war that they had been through. So it's being able to live another way that's not just from that trauma in the past.
I think that was a great answer, and you know, obviously a great project that you were involved with and are still involved with. I want to read a comment, not a question, from an audience member, Garrett Hongo, the poet and memoir.
Hi, Garrett.
We both know. No question, he says, but just want to say it's been wonderful being in your presence. Max, our great Kapuna elder, and our genius brother, Viet. Hey, love Max's stories and Viet's deft and genial questions. Mahalos. So thank you so much for that, Garrett. Glad to know you're out there. We have a question from an audience member, Jay Anderson, that I think is really relevant to the conversation we've been having about war and trauma and reconciliation and healing. And resistance. I was struck, Jay Anderson writes, in reading The Woman Warrior by the fact that the warrior's study begins with learning how to be quiet. What value do you think quietude has as a means of resistance or affecting change?
Hmm. at the beginning of my writing, I was fighting with silence. I was fighting my own silence, my inability to tell my stories, and also my inability to speak up in class or with other people. So there is the bad kind of silence, which we have to work to make music and sound and to go through that silence. Then there is the good silence, which is the silence that we have when we are in meditation. In meditation, we are quiet so that we will be able to hear, to be able to bring in peace and quiet. But we can somehow find or make peace and quiet by being silent. If you can have we could do this by ourselves, but I find it very wonderful to be in silence with other people so that we can make a strong silence, that we can make connections without chattering to one another. We can feel the ambiance, the atmosphere that we have together, and then we can feel the silence that's under the willow tree that the tree is making. And in that silence, we can also hear music. We can hear the voices of, it's the voices of saints and Buddhas, they can come in. So, oh yeah, and your idea that silence could change the world, you said something like that. And if more of us could sit in peace and quiet, that does change this noisy world.
Couple of last questions to wrap things up here. You know, you wrote an essay at one point in your life after The Woman Warrior called Cultural Misreadings by American Reviewers. Very influential for me when I read it as a student, being aware that here's a writer who is not afraid to fight back, you know, and left me with a sense that for those of us who are so-called minority writers, you know, sometimes we just can't leave it up to the critics. Because the critics may not be coming from the same worldview that we're coming from. And sometimes we have to assert what it is that we're doing and, you know, defend ourselves. I'm just wondering now at in this phase of your career and life, and you think back retrospectively and you have a biography being written about you, are there any bones you still want to pick with the critics? Are there things that you want your critics to know about your work now and in the future?
No, after that review on NPR that John Powers did, that is the ultimate, where he just, I have never seen such praise of anyone. And he is a critic. There is no arguing with that.
All right. Well, I hope that the John Powers sentiment, not just his review, but the sentiment that John Powers expressed in the NPR review will be the final word, but there will be many other critics adding to the final word. Okay, last thing for you as a, I don't know what the expression is, as an august, esteemed writer, are there any writers you would recommend to the audience? This is a question partly from the audience from Margaret Schramm, but I think a lot of people want to know. Who are you reading? Who are you recommending? Who should we be paying attention to?
Well, I'll just tell you what I'm reading right now. It's called The Well-Gardened Mind, and it's by Sue Stewart Smith. And I am in the middle of reading it, and it is such a life-affirming book. She is a psychiatrist. She is also, I see her as a botanist. She is a gardener. She is a writer. And she has, she's a historian. And she has put all kinds of feelings and thoughts into, very important during this time of climate change, the way she writes about nature, very much like Thoreau writing about nature. I find this book very hopeful and for the world and for my life. So read The Well-Gardened Mind.
It's in the chat. I found the link. It's not to Amazon. It's to Simon & Schuster, the publisher. Don't buy your book from Amazon. Call up your local bookstore or go to bookshop.org or anywhere else. Thank you so much. That's a great recommendation, a great tone, a note to end our conversation with. Maxine, it's been my pleasure and my honor to be the editor of the Library of America volume of your work. I hope I have redeemed myself from my ignominious days as your student at Berkeley. And I look forward to future conversations as well as your life and your career goes on to its next stage. Thanks so much. And thank you to everybody in the audience.
Thank you, Viet. And I hope I have redeemed myself as a teacher.
Absolutely.
Aloha, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.